us. The blood of the first men flows in my veins as much as yours, boy. You would do well to remember that I was named for your grandfather. I raised my banners against King Ares for your father, and against King Joffrey for you. At Oxcross and the Whispering Wood, and in the Battle of the Camps, I rode beside you, and I stood with Lord Eddard on the Trident. We are kin, Stark and Karstark. This kinship did not stop you from betraying me, Rob said, and it will not save you now. Kneel, my lord. Lord Rickard has spoken truly, Catelyn knew. The Karstarks trace their descent to Carlan Stark, a younger son of Winterfell who had put down a rebel lord 1,000 years ago and had been granted lands for his valour. The castle he built had been named Carl's Hold, but that soon became Carhold, and over the centuries the Carhold Starks had become Karstarks. "Old gods on you, it makes no matter," Lord Rickard told her son. "No man is so accursed as the Kinslayer." "Kneel, traitor," Rob said again, "or must have them force your head onto the block." Lord Karstark knelt. "The gods shall judge you, as you have judged me." He laid his head upon the block. "Rickard Karstark, Lord of Carhold." Rob lifted the heavy axe with both hands. "Here in the sight of gods and men, I judge you guilty of murder and high treason. In mine own name I condemn you. With mine own hand I take your life. Would you speak a final word?" "Kill me, and be cursed. You are no king of mine." The axe crashed down. Heavy and well honed, it killed at a single blow. But it took three to sever the man's head from his body, and by the time it was done, both living and dead were drenched in blood. Rob flung the pole axe down in disgust and turned wordless to the heart tree. He stood shaking, with his hands half clenched, and the rain running down his cheeks. "Gods forgive him," Catelyn prayed in silence. "He's only a boy, and he had no other choice." That was the last she saw of her son that day. The rain continued all through the morning, lashing the surface of the rivers and turning the godswood grass into mud and puddles. The Blackfish assembled 100 men and rode out after Karstarks, but no one expected he would bring back many. "I only pray I do not need to hang them," he said as he departed. When he was gone, Catelyn retreated to her father Solar to sit once more beside Lord Hoster's bed. "It will not be much longer," Maester Wyman warned her when he came that afternoon. "His last strength is going, though still he tries to fight."
"He was ever a fighter," she said, "a sweet, stubborn man."
"Yes," the maester said, "but this battle he cannot win. It is time he lay down his sword and shield. Time to yield."
To yield, she thought, to make a peace.
Was it her father the maester was speaking of, or her son? At evenfall, Jane Westling came to see her. The young queen entered the Solar timidly. "Lady Catelyn, I do not mean to disturb you." "You are most welcome here, your grace." Catelyn had been sewing, but she put the needle aside now. "Please, call me Jane. I don't feel like a grace."
"You are one, nonetheless. Please, come sit, your grace."
"Jane."
She sat by the hearth and smoothed her skirt out anxiously.
"As you wish. How might I serve you, Jane?"
"It's Rob," the girl said. "He's so miserable, so angry and disconsolate. I don't know what to do."
"It is a hard thing to take a man's life."
"I know. I told him he should use a headsman. When Lord Tywin sends a man to die, all he does is give the command. It's easier that way, don't you think?"
"Yes," said Catelyn. "But my lord husband taught his sons that killing should never be easy."
"Oh." Queen Jane wet her lips. "Rob has not eaten all day. I had Roland bring him a nice supper, boar's ribs and stewed onions and ale, but he never touched a bite of it. He spent all morning writing a letter, and told me not to disturb him, but when the letter was done, he burned it. Now he's sitting and looking at maps. I asked him what he was looking for, but he never answered. I don't think he even heard me. He wouldn't even change out of his clothes. They were damp all day and bloody. I want to be a good wife to him, I do, but I don't know how to help, to cheer him or comfort him. I don't know what he needs. Please, my lady, you're his mother. Tell me what I should do.
Tell me what I should do.
Catelyn might have asked the same, if her father had been well enough to ask. But Lord Huster was gone, or near enough. Her Ned as well. Bran, and Rickon too, and Mother, and Brandon so long ago. Only Rob remained to her, Rob, and the fading hope of her daughters. Sometimes, Catelyn said slowly, the best thing you can do is nothing. When I first came to Winterfell, I was hurt whenever Ned went to the Guardswood to sit beneath his heart tree. Part of his soul was in that tree, I knew, a part I would never share. Yet without that part, I soon realized he would not have been Ned. Jane, child, you have wed the North as I did, and in the North the winters will come. She tried to smile. Be patient. Be understanding. He loves you, and he needs you, and he will come back to you soon enough. This very night, perhaps. Be there when he does. That's all I can tell you. The young queen listened raptly. I will, she said when Catelyn was done. I'll be there. She got to her feet. I should go back. He might have missed me. I'll see. But if he's still at his maps, I'll be patient. Do, said Catelyn. But when the girl was at the door, she thought of something else. Jane, she called after, there's one more thing Rob needs from you, though he may not know it yet himself. A king must have an heir. The girl smiled at that. My mother says the same. She makes a posset for me, herbs and milk and ale, to help make me fertile. I drink it every morning. I told Rob I'm sure to give him twins, an Eddard and a Brandon. He liked that, I think. We try most every day, my lady. Sometimes twice or more. The girl blushed very prettily. I'll be with child soon, I promise. I pray to our mother above every night.
Very good. I will add my prayers as well, to the old gods and the new.
When the girl had gone, Catelyn turned back to her father and smoothed the thin white hair across his brow. An Eddard and a Brandon, she sighed softly. And perhaps in time, a Huster. Would you like that? He did not answer, but she had never expected that he would. As the sound of the rain on the roof mingled with her father's breathing, she thought about Jane. The girl did seem to have a good heart, just as Rob had said, and good hips, which might be more important.
Jamie. 2 days' ride to either side of the King's Road, they passed through a wide swathe of destruction. Miles of blackened fields and orchards, where the trunks of dead trees jutted into the air like archers' stakes. The bridges were burnt as well, and the streams swollen by autumn rains, so they had to range along the banks in search of fords. The knights were alive with howling of wolves, but they saw no people. At Maidenpool, Lord Mouton's red salmon still flew above the castle on its hill, but the town walls were deserted, the gates smashed, half the homes and shops burned or plundered. They saw nothing living but a few feral dogs that went slinking away at the sound of their approach. The pool from which the town took its name, where legend said that Florian the Fool had first glimpsed Jonquil bathing with her sisters, was so choked with rotting corpses that the water had turned into a murky grey-green soup.
Jamie took one look and burst into song. Six maids there were, in a spring-fed pool.
What are you doing?
Brian demanded.
Singing. Six maids in a pool, I'm sure you've heard it. And shy little maids they were, too, rather like you, though somewhat prettier, I'll warrant.
Be quiet, the wench said, with a look that suggested she would love to leave him floating in the pool among the corpses.
Please, Jamie, pleaded Cousin Cleos. Lord Mouton is sworn to Riverrun. We don't want to draw him out of his castle, and there may be other enemies hiding in the rubble.
Hers or ours? They're not the same, cuz. I have a yen to see if the wench can use that sword she wears.
If you won't be quiet, you'll leave me no choice but to gag you, Kingslayer.
Unchain my hands, and I'll play mute all the way to King's Landing. Now what could be fairer than that, wench?
Brian! My name is Brian!
Three crows went flapping into the air, startled at the sound.
Care for a bath, Brian?
He laughed. You're a maiden, and there's the pool. I'll wash your back. He used to scrub Circe's back when they were children together at Casterly Rock. The wench turned her horse's head and trotted away. Jamie and Sir Cleos followed her out of the ashes of Maidenpool. A half mile on, green began to creep back into the world once more. Jamie was glad. The burned lands reminded him too much of Ares.
"She's taking the Duskendale Road," Sir Cleos muttered.
"It would be safer to follow the coast."
"Safer, but slower. I'm for Duskendale, cuz, if truth be told, I'm bored with your company.
You may be half Lannister, but you're a far cry from my sister." He could never bear to be long apart from his twin. Even as children, they would creep into each other's beds and sleep with their arms entwined, even in the womb. Long before his sister's flowering, or the advent of his own manhood, they had seen mares and stallions in the fields, and dogs and bitches in the kennels, and played at doing the same. Once their mother's maid had caught them at it. He did not recall just what they had been doing, but whatever it was had horrified Lady Joanna. She'd sent the maid away, moved Jamie's bedchamber to the other side of Casterly Rock, set a guard outside Circe's, and told them that they must never do that again, or she would have no choice but to tell their lord father. They need not have feared, though. It was not long after that she died birthing Tyrion. Jamie barely remembered what his mother had looked like. Perhaps Stannis Baratheon and the Starks had done him a kindness. They had spread their tale of incest all over the Seven Kingdoms, so there was nothing left to hide.
Why shouldn't I marry Cersei openly and share her bed every night? The dragons always married their sisters.
Septons, lords, and small folk had turned a blind eye to the Targaryens for hundreds of years. Let them do the same for House Lannister. It would play havoc with Joffrey's claim to the crown, to be sure, but in the end it had been swords that had won the Iron Throne for Robert, and swords could keep Joffrey there as well, regardless of whose seed he was.
We could marry him to Myrcella, once we sent Sansa Stark back to her mother. That would show the realm that the Lannisters are above their laws, like guards and Targaryens.
Jaime had decided that he would return Sansa, and the younger girl as well, if she could be found. It was not like to win him back his lost honour, but the notion of keeping faith when they all expected betrayal amused him more than he could say. They were riding past a trampled wheat field and a low stone wall when Jamie heard a soft thrum from behind, as if a dozen birds had taken flight at once.
"Down!"
he shouted, throwing himself against the neck of his horse. The gelding screamed and reared as an arrow took him in the rump. Other shafts went hissing past. Jamie saw Sir Cleos lurch from the saddle, twisting as his foot caught in the stirrup. His palfrey bolted, and Frey was dragged past, shouting, head bouncing against the ground. Jamie's gelding lumbered off ponderously, blowing and snorting in pain. He craned around to look for Brienne. She was still a horse, an arrow lodged in her back and another in her leg. But she seemed not to feel them. He saw her pull her sword and wheel in a circle, searching for the bowman.
"Behind the wall!"
Jamie called, fighting to turn his half-blind mount back toward the fight. The reins were tangled in his damn chains, and the air was full of arrows again. "At them!" he shouted, kicking to show her how it was done. The old sorry horse found a burst of speed from somewhere. Suddenly they were racing across the wheat field, throwing up clouds of chaff. Jamie had just enough time to think. The wench had better follow before they realize they're being charged by an unarmed man in chains. Then he heard her coming hard behind. "Even fall!" she shouted as her plough horse thundered by. She brandished her longsword. "Tarth! Tarth!" A few last arrows sped harmlessly past. Then the bowman broke and ran. The way unsupported bowmen always broke and ran before the charge of knights. Brian reined up at the wall. By the time Jamie reached her, they had all melted into the wood 20 yards away. "Lost your tears for battle?" "They were running." "That's the best time to kill them." She sheathed her sword. "Why did you charge?" "Bowmen are fearless so long as they can hide behind walls and shoot at you from afar, but if you come at them, they run. They know what will happen when you reach them. You have an arrow in your back, you know, and another in your leg. You're to let me tend them." "You? Who else?" "The last I saw of Cousin Cleos, his palfrey was using his head to plough a furrow. I suppose we ought to find him. He is a Lannister of sorts." They found Cleos still tangled in his stirrup. He had an arrow through his right arm and a second in his chest, but it was the ground that had done for him. The top of his head was matted with blood and mushy to the touch, pieces of broken bone moving under the skin beneath the pressure of Jamie's hand. Brian knelt and held his hand. "He's still warm. He'll cool soon enough. I want his horse and his clothes. I'm weary of rags and fleas." "He was your cousin." The wench was shocked. "Was," Jamie agreed. "Have no fear. I'm amply provisioned in cousins. I'll have his sword as well. You need someone to share the watches." "You can stand a watch without weapons?" She rose. "Chained to a tree? Perhaps I could, or perhaps I could make my own bargain with the next lot of outlaws, and let them slit that thick neck of yours, wench." "I will not arm you, and my name is Brian, I know. I'll swear an oath not to harm you, if that will ease your girlish fears." "Your oaths are worthless. You swore an oath to Ares. You haven't cooked anyone in their armor, so far as I know, and we both want me safe and whole in King's Landing, don't we?" He squatted beside Cleos and began to undo his sword belt. "Step away from him now. Stop that." Jamie was tired, tired of her suspicions, tired of her insults, tired of her crooked teeth and her broad, spotty face and that limp, thin hair of hers. Ignoring her protests, he grasped the hilt of his cousin's longsword with both hands, held the corpse down with his foot, and pulled. As the blade slid from the scabbard, he was already pivoting, bringing the sword around and up in a swift, deadly arc. Steel met steel with a ringing, bone-jarring clang. Somehow Brian had gotten her own blade out in time. Jamie laughed. "Very good, wench."
"Give me the sword, Kingslayer."
"Oh, I will." He sprang to his feet and drove at her, the long sword alive in his hands. Brian jumped back, parrying, but he followed, pressing the attack. No sooner did she turn one cut than the next was upon her. The swords kissed and sprang apart and kissed again. Jamie's blood was singing. This was what he was meant for. He never felt so alive as when he was fighting, with death balanced on every stroke. "And with my wrist chained together, the wench may even give me a contest for a time." His chains forced him to use a two-handed grip, though, of course, the weight and reach were far less than if the blade had been a true two-handed greatsword, but what did it matter? His cousin's sword was long enough to write an end to this Brian of Tarth. High, low, overhand, he rained down steel upon her, left, right, backslash, swinging so hard the sparks flew when the swords came together, upswing, sideslash, overhand, always attacking, moving into her, step and slide, strike and step and strike, hacking and slashing, faster, faster, faster. Until breathless, he stepped back and let the point of the sword fall to the ground, giving her a moment of respite. "Not half bad," he acknowledged. "For a wench?" She took a slow, deep breath, her eyes watching him warily. "I would not hurt you, Kingslayer." "As if you could." He whirled the blade back above his head and flew at her again, chains rattling. Jamie could not have said how long he pressed the attack. It might have been minutes or it might have been hours. Time slept when swords woke. He drove her away from his cousin's corpse, drove her across the road, drove her into the trees. She stumbled once on a route she never saw, and for a moment he thought she was done. But she went to one knee instead of falling and never lost a beat. Her sword leapt up to block a downcut that would have opened her from shoulder to groin, and then she cut at him again and again, fighting her way back to her feet, stroke by stroke. The dance went on. He pinned her against an oak, cursed as she slipped away, followed her through a shallow brook, half choked with fallen leaves. Steel rang, steel sang, steel screamed and sparked and scraped. And the woman started grunting like a sow at every crash. Yet somehow he could not reach her. It was as if she had an iron cage around her that stopped every blow. "Not bad, at all," he said, when he paused for a second to catch his breath, circling to her right.
"For a wench?"
"For a squire, say? A green one?" He laughed, a ragged, breathless laugh. "Come on. Come on, my sweetling. The music's still playing. Might I have this dance, my lady?" Grunting, she came at him, blade whirling, and suddenly it was Jamie struggling to keep steel from skin. One of her slashes raked across his brow, and blood ran down into his right eye. "The others take her, and river run as well." His skills had gone to rust and rot in that bloody dungeon, and the chains were no great help either. His eye closed, his shoulders were going numb from the jarring they'd taken, and his wrists ached from the weight of chains, manacles, and sword. His long sword grew heavier with every blow, and Jamie knew he was not swinging it as quickly as he'd done earlier, nor raising it as high. "She is stronger than I am." The realization chilled him. Robert had been stronger than him, to be sure. The White Bull, Gerald Hightower as well, in his heyday, and Sir Arthur Dane. Amongst the living, great John Umber was stronger. Strongbore of Crakehall, most likely. Both Cleganes, for a certainty. The mountain's strength was like nothing human. It did not matter. With speed and skill, Jamie could beat them all. But this was a woman. A huge cow of a woman, to be sure. But even so, by rights, she should be the one wearing down. Instead, she forced him back into the brook again, shouting, "Yield! Throw down the sword!" A slick stone turned onto Jamie's foot. As he felt himself falling, he twisted the mischance into a diving lunge. His point scraped past her parry and bit into her upper thigh. A red flower blossomed, and Jamie had an instant to savor the sight of her blood before his knee slammed into a rock. The pain was blinding. Brian splashed into him and kicked away his sword. "Yield!" Jamie drove his shoulder into her legs, bringing her down on top of him. They rolled, kicking and punching until finally she was sitting astride him. He managed to jerk her dagger from its sheath, but before he could plunge it into her belly, she caught his wrist and slammed his hands back on a rock so hard he thought she'd wrenched an arm from its socket. Her other hand spread across his face. "Yield!" She shoved his head down, held it under, pulled it up. "Yield!" Jamie spit water into her face. A shove, a splash, and he was under again, kicking uselessly, fighting to breathe. Up again. "Yield, or I'll drown you."
"And break your oath?" he snarled. "Like me?"
She let him go, and he went down with a splash. And the woods rang with coarse laughter. Brian lurched to her feet. She was all mud and blood below the waist, her clothing askew, her face red.
"She looks as if they caught us fucking instead of fighting."
Jamie crawled over the rocks to shallow water, wiping the blood from his eye with his chained hands. Our men lined both sides of the brook. Small wonder we were making enough noise to wake a dragon.
"Well met, friends,"
he called to them amiably.
My pardons if I disturbed you. You caught me chastising my wife.
Seems to me she was doing the chastising.
The man who spoke was thick and powerful, and the nasal bar of his iron half-helm did not wholly conceal his lack of a nose. These were not the outlaws who had killed Sir Cleos, Jamie realized suddenly. The scum of the earth surrounded them, swarthy Dornishmen, and blond Lyseni. Dothraki with bells in their braids, hairy Ebonese, coal-black summer islanders in feathered cloaks. He knew them, the brave companions. Brayne found her voice. "I have 100 stags." A cadaverous man in a tattered leather cloak said,
"We'll take that first start, milady." "And then we'll have your cunt," said the noseless man. "It can't be as ugly as the rest of you."
"Turn her over and rape her ass," roared, urged a Dornish spearman with a red silk scarf wound about his helm. "That way you won't need to look at her."
"And rub her on the pleasure of looking at me,"
Noseless said, and the others laughed. Ugly and stubborn though she might be, the wench deserved better than to be gang-raped by such refuse as these. "Who commands here?" Jamie demanded loudly.
"I have that honour, Sir Jamie."
The cadaver's eyes were rimmed in red, his hair thin and dry. Dark blue veins could be seen through the pallid skin of his hands and face.
"Urswick I am, called Urswick the Faithful."
"You know who I am?" The sellsword inclined his head.
"It takes more than a beard and a shaved head to deceive the brave companions."
"The bloody mummers, you mean?" Jamie had no more use for these than he did for Gregor Clegane or Amory Lorch. Dogs, his father called them all, and he used them like dogs to hound his prey and put fear in their hearts. "If you know me, Urswick, you know you'll have your reward. A Lannister always pays his debts. As for the wench, she's high-born and worth a good ransom." The other cocked his head.
"Is it so? How fortunate."
There was something sly about the way Urswick was smiling that Jamie did not like. "You heard me. Where's the goat?"
"A few hours distant. He will be pleased to see you, I've no doubt. But I would not call him a goat to his face. Lord Vargo grows prickly about his dignity."
"Since when has that slobbering savage had dignity?" "I'll be sure and remember that when I see him. Lord of what, pray?"
"Harrenhal, it has been promised."
"Harrenhal? Has my father taken leave of his senses?" Jamie raised his hands. "I'll have these chains off." Urswick's chuckle was papery dry. "Something is very wrong here." Jamie gave no sign of his discomfiture, but only smiled. "Did I say something amusing?" Noseless grinned.
"You're the funniest thing I've seen since Barter chewed that scepter's tits off."
"You and your father lost too many battles," offered the Dornishman. "We had to trade our lion pelts for wolfskins." Urswick spread his hands.
"What Timian means to say is that the brave companions are no longer in the hire of House Lannister. We now serve Lord Bolton and the King in the North."
Jamie gave him a cold, contemptuous smile. "And men say I have shit for honour." Urswick was unhappy with that comment. At his signal, two of the mummers grasped Jamie by the arms, and Rogue drove a mailed fist into his stomach. As he doubled over, grunting, he heard the wench protesting.
"Stop! He's not to be armed. Lady Catelyn sent us an exchange of captives. He's under my protection."
Rogue hit him again, driving the air from his lungs. Brayne dove for her sword beneath the waters of the brook, but the mummers were on her before she could lay hands on it. Strong as she was, it took four of them to beat her into submission. By the end, the wench's face was as swollen and bloody as Jamie's must have been, and they had knocked out two of her teeth. It did nothing to improve her appearance. Stumbling and bleeding, the two captives were dragged back through the woods to the horses.
Brian limping from the thigh wound he'd given her in the brook. Jamie felt sorry for her. She would lose her maidenhood tonight, he had no doubt. That noseless bastard would have her for a certainty, and some of the others would likely take a turn. The Dornishman bound them back to back atop Brian's plough horse, while the other mummers were stripping Cleos Frey to his skin to divvy up his possessions. Rorg won the blood-stained surcoat with his proud Lannister and Frey quarterings. The arrows had punched holes through lions and towers alike. "I hope you're pleased, wench," Jamie whispered at Brian. He coughed and spat out a mouthful of blood. "If you'd armed me, we'd never have been taken." She made no answer. "There's a pig, stubborn bitch," he thought. "But brave, yes. He could not take that from her. When we make camp for the night, you'll be raped, and more than once," he warned her. "You'd be wise not to resist. If you fight them, you'll lose more than a few teeth." He felt Brian's back stiffen against his. "Is that what you would do, if you were a woman?"
"If I were a woman, I'd be Cersei."
"If I were a woman, I'd make them kill me. But I'm not." Jamie kicked their horse into a trot. "Urswick, a word." The cadaverous sellsword in the ragged leather cloak reined up a moment and fell in beside him.
"What will you have of me, sir? And mind your tongue, or I'll chastise you again."
"Gold," said Jamie. "You do like gold."
Urswick studied him through reddened eyes.
"It has its uses, I do confess."
Jamie gave Urswick a knowing smile. "All the gold in Casterly Rock.
Why, let the goat enjoy it. Why not take us to King's Landing and collect my ransom for yourself? Hers as well, if you like. Tarth is called the Sapphire Isle, a maiden told me once."
The wench squirmed at that, but said nothing.
"Do you take me for a turncloak?"
"Certainly. What else?"
For half a heartbeat, Urswick considered the proposition.
"King's Landing is a long way, and your father is there. Lord Tywin may resent us for selling Harrenhal to Lord Bolton."
"He's cleverer than he looks."
Jamie had been looking forward to hanging the wretch while his pockets bulged with gold.
"Leave me to deal with my father. I'll get your royal pardon for any crimes you have committed. I'll get you a knighthood."
"Sir Urswick," the man said, savouring the sound, "how proud my dear wife would be to hear it. If only I hadn't killed her."
He sighed.
"And what of brave Lord Vargo?"
"Shall I sing you a verse of the reigns of Castamere? The goat won't be quite so brave when my father gets hold of him."
"And how will he do that? Are your father's arms so long they can reach over the walls of Harrenhal and pluck us out?"
"If need be. King Harren's monstrous folly had fallen before, and it could fall again.
Are you such a fool as to think the goat can outfight the lion?"
Urswick leaned over and slapped him lazily across the face. The sheer casual insolence of it was worse than the blow itself.
"He does not fear me," Jamie realized with a chill.
"I've heard enough, Kingslayer. I would have to be a great fool indeed to believe the promises of an oath-breaker like you."
He kicked his horse and galloped smartly ahead.
"Ares," Jamie thought resentfully. "It always turns on Ares."
He swayed with the motion of his horse, wishing for a sword.
"Two swords would be even better. One for the wench and one for me. We'd die, but we'd take half of them down to hell with us."
"Why did you tell him Tarth was the Sapphire Isle?"
Brian whispered, when Urswick was out of earshot.
"He's like to think my father's rich in gemstones."
"You best pray he does."
"Is every word you say a lie, Kingslayers? Tarth is called the Sapphire Isle for the blue of its waters." "Shout it a little louder, wench. I don't think Urswick heard you." "The sooner they know how little you're worth in ransom, the sooner the rapes begin. Every man here will mount you.
But what do you care? Just close your eyes, open your legs, and pretend they're all Lord Renly.
Mercifully, that shut her mouth for a time. The day was almost done by the time they found Vargo Hoat, sacking a small sept with another dozen of his brave companions. The leaded windows had been smashed, the carved wooden guards dragged out into the sunlight. The fattest Dothraki Jamie had ever seen was sitting on the mother's chest when they rode up, prying out her chalcedony eyes with the point of his knife. Nearby, a skinny, balding septon hung upside down from the limb of a spreading chestnut tree. Three of the brave companions were using his corpse for an archery butt. One of them must have been good. The dead man had arrows through both of his eyes. When the sellsword spied Urswick and the captives, a cry went up in half a dozen tongues. The goat was seated by a cook fire, eating a half-cooked bird off a skewer, grease and blood running down his fingers into his long, stringy beard. He wiped his hands on his tunic and rose.
"Kingslayer," he slubbered, "you are my captive."
"My lord, I am Brienne of Tarth," the wench called out. "Lady Catelyn Stark commanded me to deliver Sir Jamie to his brother at King's Landing."
The goat gave her a disinterested glance.
"Silence, sir."
"Hear me," Brienne entreated, as Rorg cut the ropes that bound her to Jamie. "In the name of the King of the North, the king you serve, please listen."
Rorg dragged her off the horse and began to kick her.
"See that he don't break any bones," Urswick called out to him. "The horse-faced bitch is worth a weight in sapphires."
The Dornish man, Timian, and a foul-smelling Ibanez pulled Jamie down from the saddle and shoved him roughly toward the cook fire. It would not have been hard for him to have grasped one of their sword hilts as they manhandled him, but there were too many, and he was still in fetters. He might cut down one or two, but in the end he would die for it. Jamie was not ready to die just yet, and certainly not for the likes of Brienne of Tarth.
"This is a sweet day,"
Vargo Hoat said. Around his neck hung a chain of linked coins, coins of every shape and size, cast and hammered, bearing the likenesses of kings, wizards, gods and demons, and all manner of fanciful beasts.
"Coins from every land where he has fought," Jamie remembered.
Greed was the key to this man.
"If he was turned once, he can be turned again.
Lord Vargo, you were foolish to leave my father's service, but it is not too late to make amends. He will pay well for me, you know it."
"Oh, yes," said Vargo Hoat. "Half the gold in Casterly Rock I shall have, but first I must send him a message."
He said something in his slithery, goatish tongue. Urswick shoved him in the back, and a jester in green and pink motley kicked his legs out from under him. When he hit the ground, one of the archers grabbed the chain between Jamie's wrists and used it to yank his arms out in front of him. The fat Dothraki put aside his knife to unsheathe a huge curved arrack, the wickedly sharp scythe sword the horse lords loved.
"They mean to scare me."
The fool hopped on Jamie's back, giggling, as the Dothraki swaggered toward him.
"The goat wants me to piss my breeches and beg his mercy. But he'll never have that pleasure."
He was a Lannister of Casterly Rock, Lord Commander of the King's Guard. No sellsword would make him scream. Sunlight ran silver along the edge of the arrack as it came shivering down almost too fast to see. And Jamie screamed. Arya. The small square keep was half a ruin, and so, too, the great grey knight who lived there. He was so old, he did not understand their questions. No matter what was said to him, he would only smile and mutter,
"I held the bridge against the Maenor. Red hair and a black temper he had, but he could not move me. 6 wounds I took before I killed him. 6.
The maester who cared for him was a young man, thankfully. After the old knight had drifted to sleep in his chair, he took them aside and said, "I fear you seek a ghost. We had a bird, ages ago, half a year at least. The Lannisters caught Lord Beric, near the God's Eye. He was hanged."
"Aye, hanged he was, but Thoris cut him down before he died."
Lem's broken nose was not so red or swollen as it had been, but it was healing crooked, giving his face a lopsided look.
"His lordship's a hard man to kill, he is."
"An hard man to find, it would seem," the maester said. "Have you asked the Lady of the Leaves?"
"We shall," said Greenbeard.
The next morning, as they crossed the little stone bridge behind the keep, Gendry wondered if this was the bridge the old man had fought over. No one knew.
"Most like it is," said Jack Belocchi. "Don't see no other bridges."
"You'd know for certain if there was a song," said Tom Sevenstrings. "One good song, and we'd know who Sir Maynard used to be, and why he wanted to cross this bridge so bad. Poor old Leicester might be as far famed as a Dragon Knight, if he'd only had sense enough to keep a singer."
"Lord Leicester's sons died in Robert's Rebellion," grumbled Lem. "Some on one side, some on t'other. He's not been right in the head since. No bloody songs like to help any of that."
"What did the maester mean about asking the Lady of the Leaves?" Arre asked Angai as they rode. The archer smiled. "Wait and see." 3 days later, as they rode through a yellow wood, Jack Belocchi unslung his horn and blew a signal, a different one than before. The sounds had scarcely died away when rope ladders unrolled from the limbs of trees.
"Up are the horses, and up we go," said Tom, half singing the words.
They climbed to a hidden village in the upper branches. A maze of rope walkways and little moss-covered houses concealed behind walls of red and gold, and were taken to the Lady of the Leaves, a stick-thin, white-haired woman dressed in rough spun.
"We cannot stay here much longer with autumn on us," she told them. "A dozen wolves went down the Hayford Road 9 days past, hunting. If they chanced to look up, they might have seen us."
"You've not seen Lord Beric?" asked Tom Sevenstrings.
"He's dead."
The woman sounded sick.
"The mountain caught him, and drove a dagger through his eye. A begging brother told us he had it from the lips of a man who saw it happen."
"That's an old stale tale, and false," said Lem. "The Lightning Lord's not so easy to kill. Sir Gregor might have put his eye out, but a man don't die of that. Jack could tell you."
"Well, I never did," said one-eyed Jack Belocchi. "My father got himself good and hanged by Lord Piper's bailiff. My brother Wat got sent to the wall, and the Lannisters killed my other brothers. And I, that's nothing."
"You swear he's not dead?"
The woman clutched Lem's arm.
"Bless you, Lem, that's the best tiding we've had in half a year. May the warrior defend him, and the Red Priest too."
The next night they found shelter beneath the scorched shell of a sept in a burned village called Sally Dance. Only shards remained of its windows of leaded glass, and the aged septon who greeted them said the looters had even made off with the mother's costly robes, the crone's gilded lantern, and the silver crown the father had worn.
"They hacked the maiden's breast off, too, though those were only wood," he told them. "And the eyes were jet and lapis and mother of pearl. They pried them out with their knives. May the mother have mercy on them all."
"Whose work was this?" said Lem Lemoncloak. "Mummers?"
"No," the old man said. "Northmen they were, savages who worshipped trees. They wanted the Kingslayer, they said."
Arya heard him and chewed her lip. She could feel Gendry looking at her. It made her angry and ashamed. There were a dozen men living in the vault beneath the sept, amongst cobwebs and roots and broken wine casks, but they had no word of Beric Dondarrion either. Not even their leader, who wore soot-blackened armour and a crude lightning bolt on his cloak. When Greenbeard saw Arya staring at him, he laughed and said,
"The Lightning Lord is everywhere and nowhere, skinny squirrel."
"I'm not a squirrel,"
she said. I'll almost be a woman soon. I'll be 1 in 10.
Best watch out I don't marry you, then.
He tried to tickle her under the chin, but Arya slapped his stupid hand away. Lem and Gendry played tiles with their hosts that night, while Tom Sevenstrings sang a silly song about Big Belly Ben and the High Septon's Goose. Angai let Arya try his longbow, but no matter how hard she bit her lip, she could not draw it. "You need a lighter bow, m'lady," the freckled bowman said. "If there's season wood at River Run, might be I'll make you one." Tom overheard him and broke off his song. "You're a young fool, Archer. If we go to River Run, it will only be to collect a ransom. Won't be no time for you to sit about making bows. Be thankful if you get out with your hide. Lord Huster was hanging outlaws before you were shaving. And that son of his, oh, a man who hates music can't be trusted, I always say."
"It's not music he hates," says Lem. "It's you, fool."
"Well, he has no cause. The wench was willing to make a man of him. Is it my fault he drank too much to do the deed?"
Lem snorted through his broken nose.
"Was it you who made a song of it, or some other bloody ass in love with his own voice?"
"I only sang it the once," Tom complained. "And who's to say the song was about him? 'Twas a song about a fish."
"A floppy fish," said Angai, laughing.
Arya didn't care what Tom's stupid songs were about. She turned to Harwin.
"What did he mean about ransom?"
"We have sore need of horses, m'lady. Armour as well. Sword, shield, spears. All things coin can buy. Aye, and seed for planting. Winter is coming, remember?"
He touched her under the chin.
"You will not be the first high-born captive we've ransomed, nor the last, I'd hope."
That much was true, Arya knew. Knights were captured and ransomed all the time, and sometimes women were too.
"But what if Rob won't pay their price?
She wasn't a famous knight, and kings were supposed to put the realm before their sisters. And her lady mother, what would she say? Would she still want her back, after all the things she'd done?" Arya chewed her lip and wondered. The next day they rode to a place called High Hart, a hill so lofty that from atop it Arya felt as though she could see half the world. Around its brow stood a ring of huge pale stumps, all that remained of a circle of once mighty weirwoods. Arya and Gendry walked around the hill to count them. There were 31, some so wide she could have used them for a bed. High Hart had been sacred to the children of the forest, Tom Sevenstrings told her, and some of their magic lingered here still.
"No harm can ever come to those as sleep here," the singer said.
Arya thought that must be true. The hill was so high, and the surrounding land so flat, that no enemy could approach unseen.
"The small folk hereabouts shunned the place," Tom told her. "It was said to be haunted by the ghosts of the children of the forest who had died here when the Andal king, named Ereg the Kinslayer, had cut down their grove." Arya knew about the children of the forest, and about the Andals too, but ghosts did not frighten her. She used to hide in the crypts of Winterfell when she was little, and play games of "Come into my castle," and "Monsters and Maidens," amongst the stone kings on their thrones. Yet even so, the hair on the back of her neck stood up that night. She had been asleep, but the storm woke her. The wind pulled the coverlet right off her and sent it swirling into the bushes. When she went after it, she heard voices. Beside the embers of their campfire, she saw Tom, Lem, and Greenbeard talking to a tiny little woman, a foot shorter than Arya, and older than old Nan, all stooped and wrinkled, and leaning on a gnarled black cane. Her white hair was so long it came almost to the ground. When the wind gusted, it blew about her head in a fine cloud. Her flesh was whiter, the colour of milk, and it seemed to Arya that her eyes were red, though it was hard to tell from the bushes.
"The old gods stir, and will not let me sleep," she heard the woman say. "I dreamt I saw a shadow with a burning heart butchering a golden stag. I dreamt of a man without a face, waiting on the bridge that swayed and swung. On his shoulder perched a drowned crow with seaweed hanging from its wings. I dreamt of a roaring river and a woman that was a fish. Dead she drifted with red tears on her cheeks. But when her eyes did open, oh, I woke from terror. All this I dreamt, and more. Do you have the gifts for me to pay me for my dreams?
Dreams, grumbled Lem Lemminklo. What good are dreams? Fish women and drowned crows. I had a dream myself last night. I was kissing this tavern wench I used to know. Are you going to pay me for that, old woman?
The wench is dead, the woman hissed. Only worms may kiss her now.
And then to Tom Sevenstring she said,
I'll have my song, or I'll have you gone.
So the singer played for her, so soft and sad that Arya only heard snatches of the words, though the tune was half familiar. Sansa would know it, I bet. Her sister had known all the songs, and she could even play a little and sing so sweetly. All I could ever do was shout the words. The next morning, the little white woman was nowhere to be seen. As they saddled their horses, Arya asked Tom Sevenstrings if the children of the forest still dwelt on High Heart. The singer chuckled.
Saw her, did ye?
Was she a ghost? Do ghosts complain of how their joints creak? No, she's only an old dwarf woman, a queer one, though, and evil-eyed. But she knows things she has no business knowing, and sometimes she'll tell you if she likes the look of you.
Did she like the looks of you?
Arya asked doubtfully. The singer laughed.
A sound of me, at least. She always makes me sing the same bloody song, though. Not a bad song, mind you, but I know others just as good.
He shook his head.
What matters is, we have the scent now. You'll soon be seeing Thoris and the Lightning Lord, I'll wager. If you're their men, why do they hide from you?
Tom Sevenstrings rolled his eyes at that, but Harbin gave her an answer. I wouldn't call it hiding, milady, but it's true. Lord Beric moves about a lot and seldom lets on what his plans are. That way, no one can betray him. By now, there must be hundreds of us sworn to him, maybe thousands. But it wouldn't do for us all to trail along behind him. We'd eat the country bare, or get butchered in a battle by some bigger host. The way we're scattered in little bands, we can strike in a dozen places at once and be off somewhere else before they know. And when one of us is caught and put to the question, well, we can't tell them where to find Lord Beric, no matter what they do to us. He hesitated. You know what it means to be put to the question?
Arya nodded. Tickling, they called it, Polliver and Raff and all.
She told them about the village by the guard's eye, where she and Gendry had been caught, and the questions that the tickler had asked.
Is there gold hidden in the village? He would always begin. Silver, gems. Is there food? Where is Lord Beric? Which of you village folk helped him? Where did he go? How many men did he have with him? How many knights? How many bowmen? How many were horsed? How are they armed? How many wounded? Where did they go, did you say?
Just thinking of it, she could hear the shrieks again and smell the stench of blood and shit and burning flesh. He always asked the same questions, she told the outlaw solemnly, but he changed the tickling every day.
No child should be made to suffer that, Harwin said, when she was done.
The mountain lost half his men at the stone mill, we hear. Might be this tickler's floating down the Red Fork even now, with fish biting at his face. If not, well, it's one more crime they'll answer for. I've heard his lordship say this war began when the Hand sent him out to bring the king's justice to Gregor Clegane. And that's how he means for it to end. He gave her shoulder a reassuring pat. You'd best mount up, milady. It's a long day's ride to Acorn Hall, but at the end of it, we'll have a roof over our heads and a hot supper in our bellies. It was a long day's ride, but as dusk was settling, they forded a brook
and came up on Acorn Hall, with its stone-curtained walls and great oaken keep. Its master was away fighting in the retinue of his master, Lord Vance, the castle gates closed and barred in his absence. But his lady wife was an old friend of Tom Sevenstrings, and Angai said they had once been lovers. Angai often rode beside her. He was closer to her in age than any of them, but gendry, and he told her droll tales of the Dornish marches. He never fooled her, though. "He's not my friend. He's only staying close to watch me and make sure I don't ride off again." Well, Arya could watch as well. Sirio Forel had taught her how. Lady Smallwood welcomed the outlaws kindly enough, though she gave them a tongue-lashing for dragging a young girl through the war. She became even more wroth when Lem let slip that Arya was high-born. "Who dressed the poor child in those Bolton rags?" she demanded of them. "That badge! There's many a man who would hang her in half a heartbeat for wearing a flayed man on her breast." Arya promptly found herself marched upstairs, forced into a tub, and doused with scalding hot water. Lady Smallwood's maidservants scrubbed her so hard it felt like they were flaying her themselves. They even dumped in some stinky sweet stuff that smelled like flowers. And afterwards they insisted she dress herself in girls' things, brown woolen stockings and a light linen shift, and over that a light green gown with acorns embroidered all over the bodice in brown thread, and more acorns bordering the hem. "My great-aunt is a scepter at a mother-house in Old Town," Lady Smallwood said, as the women laced the gown up Arya's back. "I sent my daughter there when the war began. She'll have outgrown these things by the time she returns, no doubt. Are you fond of dancing, child? Maya Karelan's a lovely dancer. She sings beautifully as well. What do you like to do?" She scuffed a toe amongst the rushes. "Needlework. Very restful, isn't it?" "Well," said Arya, "not the way I do it." "No, I've always found it so. The gods give us each our little gifts and talents, and it's meant for us to use them, my aunt always says. Any act can be a prayer, if done as well as we are able. Isn't that a lovely thought? Remember that the next time you do your needlework. Do you work at it every day?"
"I did till I lost needle. My new one's not as good."
"In times like these, we must make do as best we can." Lady Smallwood fussed at the bodice of the gown. "Now, you look a proper young lady."
"I'm not a lady," Arya wanted to tell her. "I'm a wolf."
"I do not know who you are, child," the woman said, "and it may be that's for the best. Someone important, I fear." She smoothed down Arya's collar. "In times like these, it is better to be insignificant. Would that I could keep you here with me. That would not be safe, though. I have walls, but too few men to hold them," she sighed. Supper was being served in the hall by the time Arya was all washed and combed and dressed. Gendry took one look and laughed so hard that wine came out of his nose, until Harwin gave him a thwack alongside the ear. The meal was plain but filling. Mutton and mushrooms, brown bread, peas pudding, and baked apples with yellow cheese. When the food had been cleared and the servants sent away, Greenbeard lowered his voice to ask if her ladyship had word of the Lightning Lord.
"Word?" she smiled. "They were here, not a fortnight past. Them and a dozen more. Driving sheep. I could scarcely believe my eyes. Thoris gave me three as thanks. You've eaten one tonight."
"Thoris, herding sheep?" Angai laughed aloud. I grant you it was an odd sight, but Thoris claimed that as a priest he knew how to tend a flock."
"Aye, and shear them too," chuckled Lem Lemoncloak.
"Someone could make a rare fine song of that." Tom plucked a string on his wood harp. Lady Smallwood gave him a withering look. "Someone who doesn't rhyme carry-on with Don Darion, perhaps, or play Ole my sweet lass down in the grass to every milkmaid in the shower, and leave two of them with big bellies." "It was, let me drink your beauty,"
said Tom defensively, "and milkmaids are always glad to hear it. As was a certain high-born lady, I do recall. I play to please." Her nostrils flared.